If it doubled my salary, it'd be the same, right?
Right. So.
All right, this is the intersection of games and stories, and we'll have fun during the summer, I'm sure, like we have most of them. We'll just go through and introduce ourselves first, say a few words about it, and then pretty much we're going to open up to questions from you guys, because you know it's hard for us to read your minds and tell you what you want to know. We'd rather have you ask us what you want to know and have us try to come up with answers on the spot. Kind of like anti-Jeopardy.
You'd be embarrassed if we told you what you wanted to know in front of all these people. I'm Jeff Tidball. I'm a freelance designer. Have done lots of work on role-playing games, board games, fiction, all that stuff. My partner, Will Heinmarch, and I have a website and a press that specializes in games and stories and the overlap at gameplaywright.net. And so, gameplaywright.net
with a W. Yeah, for right.
Where we think obsessively about this stuff.
Exactly. And put out some cool books to go along with it, too.
Yeah, so we're just releasing, I got a bunch of bookmarks, come get one later, called a book called Hamlet's Hit Points that is just now or is very close to selling out at the show that Robin Laws wrote, that is a system of story analysis that is aimed at role players. The story analysis is broadly, yes, there we are, broadly applicable. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It's available at the Steve Jackson Atlas Games Adventure Retail booth, and they've probably got about a dozen left. Yeah. And the Indie Press Revolution booth has like a stash of 10 that will only go back on sale when Robin is signing them this afternoon, but otherwise they're sold out.
That's a good problem.
It is.
My name is Matt Forbeck. I've been a longtime freelancer. I started out in this industry way too long ago. I've written more role-playing game books than I can count. I used to run a company called Pinnacle Entertainment Group, which did Deadlands and Brave New World. I was the president of that for 4 years. Nowadays, I usually write mostly novels, computer games, comic books, things like that. My 13th novel just hit the shelves a week ago Tuesday, and that was Guild Wars, Ghosts of Ascalon, which is for the big MMO. And Stan has a copy. He's going to show everybody. Stan has the only copy in the world that's signed by me, the co-author, and the artist, because he hit them up at Comic-Con last week.
And what page are you on? I saw your bookmark.
about 80.
Oh, it's small. Oh, oh. Got a lot of pain in handy. So that's what I did. My first original novel is coming out in November from Angry Robot. It's a science fiction novel, and I have a fantasy, urban fantasy novel from them coming out in January as well.
So, maybe not right now, but part of the discussion we should get back to is why you chose to say original novel.
Yes. We'll do that next. We'll let you go.
I'm Stan, the guy with the exclamation point, and I also am kind of a utility player. I do game design and write fiction and do illustration and cartooning. I think my count now is 2 novels and 16 or 17 short stories and a whole bunch of games. A lot of them based on, when I was working for TSR and Wizards, I worked mostly with Dragonlance and a couple of the other, a little bit of Forgotten Realms, so a lot of interaction between the books and the fiction and how and where that overlapped and what the tension was. So I'm sure I have something to say on the subject.
Now, what Stan was saying about when I said original novels, that's the reason I've had 13 other novels published before this, and every one of them was a tie-in novel, right? That means it's based on something else that I don't own, right? Somebody who owns that stuff has a license they gave to a publisher, or in some cases, owned a publishing company of their own, and then hired me to write a novel for them. And that's work for hire, like most game work is if you're doing role-playing game stuff, which means they own that entirely. I'm just playing around in their world. And that's kind of fun, actually. When I started out doing it, I kind of thought of it as somebody else paying me to learn how to write novels, right? So my first couple novels were probably a little rougher because it was the first time I was doing it, but they were paying me to write. So, and now then original novels are ones you come up with and own yourself entirely, right? The thing about tie-ins that's kind of cool is that you get this whole big shelf of toys, and you get to take them down off the shelf, play with them, mess around with them a little bit, and part of the deal is you have to put them back in roughly the same condition you found them. But you still get to have a good, fun time at the same time.
Sometimes they tell you can break this toy.
Exactly. Like when I told Bob Salvatore to kill Chewbacca, right?
You have to break this toy.
It's a lot like the old school non-art TV shows where by the end of the show it has got to be back to the way it started so you can watch them out of order.
Exactly. It doesn't matter if you're being reruns. It doesn't matter what season it is or anything else like that. Exactly. So what do you want to say about games and stories, Mr. Gameplay?
So here, the thing about games and stories that sort of sets it all up is that the key difference between what's a game and what's a story is that in a story, some person who made up the story is telling you how it is. Here's what happens, and this is what this guy does, and this is maybe why he did it, and what comes out of that. It's a story, right? It has defined parameters. But in a game, for a game to be any good, the people who are playing it have to decide. It's an interactive thing. That's what a game is. And so the biggest tension or the biggest thing that I think to discuss in that whole space is what happens when you push these two things together and there's tension between who decides. Does the story control the stuff? Do the people at the table control the stuff? That, to my mind, is the central question or thing to talk about or thing to figure out about where games and stories come together.
And a way to look at that that's kind of more, I think, more approachable for those of you who haven't done writing in the past is comparing, just look at, ever been in a role-playing game where the DM has such a firm picture in his head that he does most of the talking the entire time and tells you when you can roll and for which skills you're going to roll?
Can I roll now?
I've certainly been in there. I've tried not to be VM. That's it. I'm sure at some points I have been. But so that's the intersection we're talking about. I mean, once it gets to the table, we are out of the equation. But you have your own tension between story and game that you go through every time you're playing. And for the author, we have that in the situation when we're writing. How much we put in when they to meet. How much we put in where we control and say, this is what's going to happen, and how much we just kind of set up on the edge and then walk away and say, okay, you decide what happens.
I've been writing a series of articles on this, actually, for The Escapist, for escapistmagazine.com. It came out every 5 weeks or so, but as part of my research looking back at this, I found out games and stories have been together since, for the adventure games, since day one, right? The first game that we usually trace the adventure game hobby back to was Little Wars by H.G. Wells, the guy who wrote The Time Machine and everything else, one of the fathers of science fiction. And he also wrote a game called Little Wars, right? Mm-hmm. But the neat thing about Little Wars is he actually illustrates some of the examples of the game by taking the general and actually telling the story from the general's point of view. So we actually have gaming fiction in the first game that was ever designed for our industry.
That's sweet.
It's pretty wild. They go back a long way. So it's the neat thing about it, like Stan was saying, is the big crossover for me for doing role-playing games and stories and worlds is that it's the world that you create, right? Because you do a lot of story design with the world, you come up with lots of possibilities for people, and then often you just let them go, right? Back in the 90s, the big thing was what we call meta-arc for role-playing games. Like if you played Shadowrun or Deadlands or Brave New World or any of a dozen other games, those games had storylines that you were following. Torg was a big one for this. Torg was a game where if you played in the official campaign and you turned in your results, they were supposed to tally all that stuff up, figure out what really happened in the world compared to all these different games were being run, and then tell you which direction the storyline went from there. Right? In the last decade or so, mostly the last decade, we've pretty much gotten away from that. Nowadays, we give players toolkits to which they can build their own stories. We give them backgrounds, we give them characters, we give them plot hooks and arcs and all that. But then we let you guys just take it and run with it. And players really seem to respond to that a lot better, actually.
Ken talked about that last night. At the Annie Awards, anybody at the Annies last night? Day after Ragnarok is Ken Height's setting that's been released into Savage Worlds and Hero and maybe other stuff. And he won the Gold Annie for setting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he said when he was accepting that award is that he found it gratifying to win that setting award because his perspective, and I think that he's largely correct, is that an RPG designer's greatest or most severe responsibility is to make a good setting, because the story of the game comes down to the players and the GM, and the protagonist, the need to craft compelling characters, falls down to the players. But there's really nobody else who can be given or accept responsibility for the setting other than the person who is creating the background and the world and stuff in that RPG.
And you actually see some books come out nowadays that are they're rule-less setting books. Right? They have no rules at all, and the books, they're harder for people to get into because they don't have the stats that you want for everything sometimes, right? But it's an easier way for a person to write. And a lot, a lot of writers who want to be novelists actually don't have any idea about plots, character arcs, any of the kind of stuff that makes for a really good novel, right? That makes you want to read it. But they're incredible world builders, right? And that's really what they like to do, is tinker around with that stuff. And a lot of those guys get into RPG design at one point or another.
Right? So you did a product back with Human Head called Redhurst.
Redhurst Academy of Magic, which did have stats in it, but it was a book that you could basically try to plug into anything that was D20, which was big stats. But the neat thing about that book was I set it up, you could plug it into any campaign because it was a traveling wizard's college. Like Harry Potter, basically. But it could teleport. It would actually come pick you up in whatever home dimension you happen to be. So you could kind of slot it into any campaign. That was a neat book. I like it. And one of Horses Award.
What about the some more rare games where, for instance, you're world burning, or you're building the setting in the game? The players, as opposed to the game designers, are taking that role. How does that alter the equation?
Well, can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
I thought it was something under from Lucrane's...
The Burning Wheel.
They have world burning.
Right.
Yeah. It's world generations,
right,
it's character generations.
If you look at Lucrane stuff, you've got Burning Wheel,
yeah.
And you've got Burning Empire, which is a science fiction game.
Yeah, I think this is for Burning Empire. Yeah.
Where he still does. He sets the world up, basically. It's just... It's pulled back further, but
right.
If people played or are familiar with Burning Wheel, Burning Empire, so on, Luke Crane's work. I have not played it myself.
I haven't played it. I've read it, and I know.
So, like, part of the shtick is that as Jason's saying, the players all step back even further into a sort of a co-creative role with the designer, where facts about the world are established as characters are created and so on. I wish I knew more about it specifically to be able to tell, because that's a good question of what happens when you do that.
Right, exactly. And there's a different level of control for different players, too. Like the Dungeon Master and the Game Master has a lot more control over that particular corner of the world that the players are playing in than the players do. The players are often, except in games like Burning Wheel and some of the other really cool indie games, they're not controlling the introduction of new characters and new plot points and new story arcs and all that kind of stuff, right? It's the Dungeon Master and the Game Master who handles all that. But, you know, we have a lot of new games are coming out where people are actually being a lot more interactive, where the players can actually take control of the game at certain points and introduce new elements, and they become more of a world builder at that point, too.
I think that really what you're looking at is, let's say, drawing the line back further. Either you're starting, you know, tabula rasa with nothing but a set of rules and a concept, in which case, as a writer, it all practically takes us out of the equation.
Yeah.
Like we're designing rules that are meant to convey an emotional kind of response or a kind of action, and then saying everything else is up to you. Or there's some incremental amounts you can start. Okay, we're going to presume it's a Tolkien style fantasy. We're going to presume it's fantasy, but not Tolkien style. And then you add on to it. All the way out to, we're presuming that it's this kingdom with these people in charge and this history, but from day X on, you take it.
And those appeal to different customers, too, right? Not everybody wants to be a world builder. You know, those I could come up with a set of charts that allow you to randomly generate plans for a system. I think Traveler actually had that at one point, right? You can actually just randomly generate a planet, right?
Yeah.
Okay, it just takes a bunch of dice. But not everybody wants to do that. Some people want to know where Tatooine is, right? They want to know where Hoth is, and they want to know all about the planet and everything else that goes along with it. And so as a writer and as a designer, I can give them either a tool set to play with, or I can give them the whole package. Right? I can give you a do-it-yourself kit, or I can say, okay, here it is done. Here's the finished piece of furniture that you're going to buy and put in your house. Right?
Or you can give them unpainted.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that we can agree that like neither of those is better than the other one, right? It just depends on whether you want to build a bookshelf or whether you want to just have one.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a hobby industry. That's one of the names for our gaming industry, our adventure gaming industry. It's traditionally hobby industry, right? Because this is something people like to do with their spare time. They like to tinker around with stuff. They like to paint miniatures. You know, they like to create new things to go into these worlds. And they like to spend a ton of time on it. So some people want the toolkit. Some people want to have the ability to cast their own miniatures, mix their own paint, do ink washes, and build this beautiful diorama, right? Other people want HeroClix. I'm a HeroClix kind of guy when I want to paint miniatures. That's it. But, you know, it's different tastes for different folks, right? And some of them are going to be more popular than others because there's going to be more people who want to do one type than another. From sales figures, we pretty much determined that most people would rather have a prepackaged game, right? That you get pretty much everything you need to go just start playing, right? But for some of us who are a little bit closer to game designers, we'd rather have the toolkit. And some of those guys will actually probably become professional game designers at some point as well. That's how a lot of us start. We all start out playing games, and we think, I can do that. I can take it. I can mess with that. And then you suddenly say, well, maybe somebody would pay me to do that. That would be cool. That's how you wind up here eventually, I guess.
Yeah. How does all this work for a board that's not so much interested in the RPG aspect of
right.
having a board and characters and everything? Like, how do you take a story and then turn it into a game, or do you have a game idea and then make a story for it? I mean, how does that?
You can do either one, actually. I was in a seminar the other day where we were talking about even just when you're writing books, you have top-down development, you have bottom-up development, right? So bottom-up, you're thinking about mechanics first, and you come up with the mechanics of the game itself, and then you design a setting or a story that fits those mechanics, right? And that's why Eric Lang likes to do it that way. Eric's a basic game designer, doesn't do story that much. I'm more of a story guy, so I'd rather come up with a story and use that metaphor of the story as the framework for my entire game system, right? And then every mechanic I come up with then has to be true to that metaphor, to that story that it's all wrapped around. And that makes it easier for me because I'm a story guy, and I know, okay, I don't need to do this, I can throw that out, and whatever. But it really can go either way.
One of the projects that I worked on for almost all of last year was the Horus Heresy board game, which is an adaptation of, frankly, the coolest event in the entire Warhammer 40,000 universe. And there is there's 3,000 or 4,000 pages worth of novels that describe that long event, and it's the foundation story of that entire IP, more or less. And so, spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to adapt that into a board game and figuring out what's involved in this game, because obviously you can't condense 3,000 or 4,000 pages of novel into a board game, to figure out which parts of that were relevant to the board game, and then. But like you were saying, that provides you with a sense of what's appropriate for the game and what's not. In the case of that Warhammer 40,000 world, it all feels very grim and punishing and horrible and so on. And so you don't want your board game playing experience to be horrible, but it should feel, right, if you feel happy and you're like killing all the guys and stuff, that's not quite right. And so one of the things that we tried to do as we playtested that game is to make it feel like you were involved in this grim campaign of destruction as to be true to the stories that are established about that world.
For fun.
For fun,
exactly. You know, and board games can be, they can have a really intricate storyline or they can be abstract to nothing, right? But most games have at least a thin veneer of story. Even chess has a thin veneer of being a war between two nations, right? But then you can have things that are much more complicated, like miniature games like Monster Apocalypse, which is technically a board game. It's got a neat story behind it. Why did these different factions come together? In fact, it was just an option for a movie that Tim Burton's going to direct, right? Because I like the story behind it.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it just announced about 2 weeks ago. It is, exactly. He's a big kaiju fan from way back.
Yeah,
Bats,
I'll
be
in 3D as well.
Yeah, probably will. And John August is doing the screenplay. So.
Yeah.
Well, I'm jealous too.
Yeah.
So it's something that's interesting is that story. I did a presentation about this at Dakota State University at a convention that they did last year, and looked at this significant objects project, which I think is at significantobjects.org maybe. So what these people have done is it's just endlessly fascinating to me. They buy objects at garage sales or whatever, right? So an example is this ashtray that they bought, this Senga brand coffee ashtray that they bought for $1. And then they have all of these authors that they work with. And they give the object to an author, and the author invents a story about whatever the thing is. So in the case of this ashtray, the story that's invented is that it was involved in this casino heist, and the people who thought they were stealing the diamond and had it in this bag got back to their hideout only to discover they had accidentally stolen the ashtray. And so then they write this story and they attach it sort of to this particular object and they put that up on eBay. And these objects then sell for 50 or 70 or 100 bucks. And it's not like they're saying this is true, because it says in the eBay auction, here is some stuff that we made up about this thing. And you will buy the object and we'll print out the story for you, but that's all you're getting out of it. And so that
demonstrates, I think, a concrete and absolute value for just a story about a thing. And in board games especially, the to paint on story is not valueless. And it right, because eBay demonstrates that there is a concrete financial value attached to the meaning that a story can put onto something else.
So when you're... Yeah.
I'm sorry, what?
No, I keep getting a prop from the movie set.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
exactly. Really involved right. with the story. Yeah. Like, I saw it on TV. But
so I think there's... it's interesting to kind of to look at this from the perspective of when you're making a game that's tied to a story, you're adapting it in the same way that someone who is writing music about it is adapting it. It's just that your adaptation is... that. They're in such closely related fields that the connection feels more close. You can look at it and say, that's not what happened on page 78, where you can't really say that to the piece of music. But it's kind of the same thing. You're taking this thing from one medium and doing something that's meant to reflect it in another medium. And because there are words and progress of events and drama that unfold, you feel like the connection is very close, and that's why these things do overlap so closely.
Are there any significant instances that you can find where board games inspired stories, and I'm not talking about the Clue movie or whatever, but are there any instances that I know that...
You mean novels about board games?
Novels.
I wrote four novels about Blood Bowl, which is a board game.
Fair enough.
And a 5-issue comic book miniseries. There you go.
Answer.
So, and there are others. I mean, technically, a lot of the games that Games Workshop comes out with are board games, and people write stuff about them all the time. I mean, there were even Dragon Dice novels, right?
Two? One?
Exactly. Dragon Dice was a collectible dice game that came out from TSR way back in the day. And they had novels about that. You can write stories about anything. Settlers of Catan is a novel that's been released in Japan, for instance. Or not Japan, Germany. Yeah. Not a translation. It's not. The translation's a little rough. I'm hoping it's a translation, right?
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, I just got commissioned to write a trilogy of novels about Dust, which is a board game by Paolo Parente.
Okay.
For Fantasy Flight is putting out right now.
Just to sort of flip it around a little bit and throw a bigger question out. Why are so many game to movie adaptations bad? Like, what's the fundamental one?
It's the same reason all adaptations can be bad, right? You know, adaptations of a book can be bad. Adaptations of anything can be bad.
Well, movie adaptations are like consistently bad.
Well, so I think part of the answer, adaptation is going to not meet your personal vision, because when you're making it, you have to have the author's personal vision. If he treats that piece of work differently than you do in your head, then it's going to be bad. But I think another part of it is what we talked about earlier, about this intersection of setting up and following through. Games, in all their formats, the follow-through is on you. And in the movie, just like in the novel, the author has to do the follow-through. And so, again, if he's coming at it from a different perspective or wants to make a different point or wants to teach you something, or just, you know, feels that this has been, this what this game is about has been done too many times, we've got to turn it on its head a little, then it's not going to resonate with you who have your own perspective about this is, when I play Warhammer, this is what the world is like. This is how things go. In the Forgotten Realms, this is what Waterdeep is like. Right? Once you get into the movie, it's what the director thinks it's like.
Bad's a hard thing to quantify. I mean, like, a lot of people say the Transformers movies are horrible, right? Yeah. They make a lot of money.
They
keep
doing them,
so. Yeah. Well, do you think there's any way to successfully adapt or
produce
a game to a story? Or is it like to take a game and turn it back into a story?
For sure. I think so. I think a lot of the reason that movie adaptations of games wind up being unsatisfying is because the reason they were adapted in the first place, the motivation was financial, probably, right? You had a very successful game, and somebody wanted to make more money off of that in other media. And when you're creating art for the purpose of money, the money guys want to get involved in what the art's going to look like, and so you've got producers and executives telling the director and the writer how it's going to be. And I don't think that's a proven way of making fantastic art.
Right. And, you know, there's often because of that a lot of respect. I have a story about Max Collins, right, who did Road to Perdition.
Right.
He did this graphic novel, and then they made a movie out of it, and then they hired him to write the novelization of the film, right? It gets better, right? Max then writes this book and thinks, okay, I'm writing a novel. There's not a lot of text in the movie. And I'm going to add in some scenes, some characters, you know, some backstory. This would be a really good story. And the editor from the publisher comes back and says, no, you can't use anything that's not in the movie, even though it's his property originally, right? So he actually had to rip all this stuff out that he had created for his own property.
Right.
But he didn't have
the
rights.
Or the license.
You see, he had licensed everything off to the movie company, and then they had licensed the publisher, and their contract with the publisher says you can only use what's in the film. And contractually, he was not allowed to do that. I know, it's absurd, right? But there you go.
We've just blown her mind.
I read the graphic novel. I haven't read the book. I read the graphic novel, saw the movie. I haven't actually read
the
book.
So he had to reduce the film, I shouldn't say reduce, to a novel and only use...
And only use the text that was in the actual dialogue from the movie. He was not allowed to add any dialogue at all.
So he could just take the screenplay and then add description.
Yeah. Actually, this is for a lot of novelizations, they tell you can only use what's in the script. Right? I was fortunate. I did the Mutant Chronicles novelization last year that came out, and the guys there actually had control over that stuff. And I knew the property from way back because I'd worked on it as a role-playing game in the early 90s. And so they said, go wild. I mean, the movie's not going to match the original game very well, but you can tweak that because we can only show so much in the movie. So in the novel, we're going to have you tie that as strongly as you can back into the original game.
And that won that award, right?
It did. Yeah, I got the Scribe Award last year for best game-related novel.
This will be a messy question. It's not fully formed.
Okay.
But I'm going to be teaching a graduate class in interactive storytelling. And unfortunately, it says for games, and I'm going to mess with that.
Okay.
And I'm thinking about an assignment where find your favorite board game. I like this idea. And I want you to write a story about it. I want you to write a story.
I'm going to be the top hat. That's all I'm
saying. Right, yeah.
And write a story about your game, but keeping in mind that you're going to adapt this into a film, and you're also going to adapt it into a video game.
Right. And that's a challenge. I mean, actually, a lot of times when you're doing basic IP development or intellectual property development, you're required to do something that will be translated to any other medium.
Yes,
right?
And because I want students to think that don't stop here.
Exactly.
But what do you think of that assignment?
I think it's a great assignment. I mean,
sitting here, I'm going, this is a good assignment.
So that's a good assignment for people in that class, frankly, because any of them who go off to get involved in production or in producing or in executive positions at any place that's doing anything creative, we'll have to write documents like that that sort of understand which parts of an IP are appropriate to go off and live in a graphic novel or a novel or a role-playing game or a film or a video game or whatever.
Well, you heard it here first.
Right.
Now we know what's going on in your class.
That's right.
You got to pay us not to tell your students ahead of time.
Slipping the syllabus. Any other questions? Come on, you guys got to know something.
What were you hoping we were going to say?
Well, it may sound kind of weird. There's a website called MS Paint Adventures that I read. And he started it off as a game, a forum game, in which he was drawing a picture in paint, and he was presenting the player with a picture, the people in the forum, and saying, what actions does this person take? And then he was responding to advance the story based on the interactions with the forum.
Oh, cool.
And he has reached a point where he's basically said he taught himself how to write doing this, and he's surpassed user input.
Right.
So he's developed this game into its own story. So I don't know, maybe that has something to do with, is there a point where a story surpasses the game, or a game surpasses the story, and they kind of...
They can, but I think they also move side by side. I mean, we're talking about a pretty unique kind of game here, right? That's a game about developing a story.
That's, I think the author was playing the game more than the...
Exactly. More like he was playing his contributors.
Yes. He's had interviews where he's talked about how he had an idea in his head of this is the way the story would go, and the readers would fight him in the forum, and he would try to be taking it a different way, and he would almost have to write an entirely different path for that because they would never go the path he would want, he had designed in the game to go.
Every game master knows what that's like.
Yeah.
All you have to do is sit down and play a game. My son's here. I'm trying to explain that to him. Every time you play a game like this, the players will figure out some way to mess it up that you had no idea was coming, right? It happens every time you play. That's actually one of the best things about the game, right? Because that's the stuff that surprises you.
That's one of the reasons why being the GM is still playing the game.
Exactly. You're not just running an entertainment for people. You know, you're involved in the participatory thing.
So one quick thing. That reminded me of a game called Once Upon a Time that you should all play. Which is a storytelling card game where all of the players are building a story together, and it's a fantastic example of where stories and games intersect best.
Yes.
It's a card game
from Atlas Games. They probably have some here.
I'm sure that they do. It is. That's at that same Steve Jackson Adventure Retail, Atlas Games, et cetera.
Okay. It is a great game. There's the Adventures of Baron Munchausen, too.
Yeah.
By James
same
Wallace,
design.
Right?
Okay.
James had a co-designer on Once Upon a Time. I forget who it was exactly.
There are two other designers.
Exactly, right.
There.
But Adventures of Baron Munchausen is like a game you play with your friends to tell stories while you're drinking wine in a smoky bar with jackets.
Yeah,
it's good fun. Right?
But if you're remotely interested in games and stories together, those two games,
they cross very well.
I was thinking of one other game which might also cross fairly well. Happy Birthday Robot.
Yeah, which I haven't actually seen yet, but Daniel Solis has got a new book that he's coming out with, and you can tell him if you like. I don't know too much.
Yeah, it's a game meant for children, I think, although it says ages 10 and up, and you're trying to add words to this emerging story.
Yeah.
So it's collaborative development of the story with game mechanics. And
I like this a lot.
Right, and the rule is that the first line of every story must be, Happy Birthday, Robot.
I played stuff like this with my kid all the time.
It's freshly out. I don't know if...
They had it here.
I don't. I would not be surprised if it sold out.
But they'll be happy to sell you one when they get home.
I'm sure.
Exactly.
One of the incredible things about Happy Birthday Robot actually is how great it looks as a product.
Yeah.
The designer, I think, is a graphic designer at an ad agency. And it's a phenomenal looking book as well as it. Like in the legit world, it would be phenomenal looking.
There's an implication there.
I take these terms from Variety where they refer to the legit stage.
You're in Hollywood too long.
So I was thinking as we were talking about that Thursday night, I went to a group of freelancers at dinner. And after dinner, they got together and played Who's the Werewolf?
Yeah.
All familiar with that?
It's a pretty classic, well, in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And
you played it.
I did. And anytime, I've played that a lot of people, and there's always bits of story. There's no story that needs to be involved, really. And the game's also, Mafia?
Yes.
Under the same name. Couple of others.
Who's played this and knows what it is?
Should
probably tell people what's up.
Yeah, I saw too many nods of recognition. I thought it was like, oh yeah, we know that.
It sounds cool.
So the concept is that you're all people living in a village, and you wake up one morning and discover somehow that there are one or more werewolves living amongst you, and the cards are dealt out. Most people get a card that indicates that they are a townsperson. Depending on the number of people playing, one or more people, or two or more people, will get cards indicating that they are werewolves. And there are other roles that you can have. You can have roles of someone gets a card that they're the seer, and they get to. So the game works in two phases. During the nighttime phase, the werewolves get to kill someone. And while everyone has their eyes closed and there's some distracting noise, they open their eyes and agree by pointing, that person's going to. And then there are other roles. Like I say, the seer is someone who then gets to open their eyes during the night and point to one person, and there's a moderator who's running the game who will tell them that person is a werewolf, that person's not a werewolf. And there are several other roles that can be given out. And then in the daytime, you wake up and the moderator tells you, oh, sorry, this guy is dead. He's shredded. So werewolves killed him. Townsfolk, you must exact justice. And the townsfolk have to decide one person among them that they think is a werewolf and they're going to hang him. And if they're wrong, well, sorry, it's the best we can do. We go to sleep again and the werewolves hunt again. And if the number of werewolves and the number of townsfolk are ever equal, then the werewolves win. And if the townsfolk can get the werewolves before then the townsfolk win, even the devils.
So it's a purely deductive game. But when you're playing it, people adopt personas and point and stand on chairs and shake their fists. And
I'm the mayor, let us rally, citizens. And this one in particular, with the freelancers, they insisted that everyone pick a job that they had in town.
Cool.
So the first thing they did was say, go around the entire room, and everyone picked a job and a perspective that they had within the town, and then the rest of the game was played in character. And it was hilariously funny. But as I say, that there was a ton of story in that game that had nothing to do with the game. It was all brought in because it just expanded the experience.
And how many players were in your game?
That one was huge. That was like 40 players.
Wow.
And it took about 3.5 to 4 hours.
But once you're killed, you're out.
You're out. But everyone who was killed stuck around to watch because it was so
fun.
Fun.
Yeah. Right.
It's a recording.
Usually something that I observe people who are to myself do is when I'm playing a game, let's say a video game, for instance, or a different kind of game, is that this just doesn't make sense, it's stupid. And then, like, there's something illogical about either the story or the rules or the mechanics or
right.
that just makes people, darn, I just wasted all my time. And I was wondering what kind of suggestions would you give to someone who is trying to write a story for a game to make it meaningful and realistic.
This is a very big problem with video games, and it has to do with the way video games are designed and developed. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that often what happens is the coders and the guys who have the idea for the game sit down, design the game out, and have no idea about story at all. Right? And they come back toward the end of the thing, and they sit down and say, well, we need to tie this level and this level together, so we're going to come up with some wonky story that kind of makes sense. They have no idea what they're doing. Right? You know, I don't know how to code that well either, so I'm not hacking them. They don't have that skill. Right? But nowadays, some of the best studios are hiring writers at the beginning, at the ground level. They bring in them in to help develop the story, the characters, and art for the game, all that kind of stuff. And then the writer goes away for a while they develop the game and do the levels and everything else, and he comes back in and he does the script and the dialogue and everything and adds all that in. The best games you see out there that are the best story-involved games like BioShock or Red Dead Redemption or any of these other games that people are praising through story were built that way. But not everybody's moved over to doing it that way yet, right? Because the thing about writing, especially in a creative company like this, everybody thinks they can write. Because right?
You wrote a letter once.
Yeah, exactly. You wrote a letter once, you wrote an essay in high school, you know, you may have written a little story that you showed to your friends or your mom.
You write emails every
day. They all loved it.
They all loved it. Mom thought it was awesome, right? But that doesn't mean you're qualified to actually construct a complicated plot with interesting and involving characters that have challenges and resolutions, the kind of things that actually make a story resonate with people, right? So that's really the problem. It's an institutional problem with a lot of these developers. And a lot of it, you know, they're small companies. Everybody's wearing several hats. The idea of hiring a writer at the beginning, when I'm sure what they're doing, never occurs to them, right? But it has changed quite a bit. The International Game Developers Association, which is the computer game developer guys, now has a writing special interest group, and we've got a mailing list, and we actually have awards that go out and all this other kind of stuff, where we're trying to promote those ideas. And I've been hired in to do a few games like that myself.
And, I mean, you'll find that that will come up in things like role-playing games and board games, too. And I think it's toughest in board games, because in role-playing games, from my perspective, when you run into those problems, the DM says, that doesn't make sense, let's just boot the rules and get around it. But in video games and board games, you are more apt to get stuck and just be stuck with this, you know, either you stop playing or you go, all right, it's dumb, let's keep going.
And I think that's bad design, though. I think if you're going to do a game, every mechanic needs to be true to the story, and the stories need to be true to the mechanic. In really good games, they all mesh together, and they don't jar you out of your experience, right? If you have to stop and say that's dumb, it breaks you out of the immersion and the enjoyment you're having in this gaming session. But not everybody has all those skills. Sometimes we have games that are done by guys who are great storytellers, and the game mechanics are kind of wonky. And sometimes we have games still done by really great game designers that have zip for story. Right? Ryan Akitsia is a great game designer, but he doesn't really do story at all. In fact, some of his games are really, really abstract. Right? Other games have got great stories wrapped around them, and either he or the publisher has worked to do that. But you can't really... There's just a lot of different ways to do it. Not everybody has all those skills. But again, in a small company, especially board game companies, are really tiny companies usually, unless you're Hasbro or Mattel. They're not going to have a dedicated story guy and staff, right? They're going to be lucky if they hire a writer as a freelancer to do this kind of stuff.
You mentioned that you wrote, I think it's a Guild Wars.
Yeah. I wrote the Guild Wars novel.
Okay, so how does that apply to MMOs, where two players can have completely different experiences and be in the same world and have contradicting events almost?
Yeah, it's hard to do a persistent world that way, but they do something called instancing, which means that when you walk into a certain section of the world, that world exists only for you. Right? That part of the world will only exist only for you. If you walk into a building and have an adventure, that part of the world only exists for you, and the other people can play through it too. Part of it, it's hard to have an ongoing developing storyline, but we work it out. You say, okay, most people have done this well, or you assume you're going to succeed here and not screw it up, because the neat thing about an MMO is you can keep trying, right? You fail the adventure, you come back later and try it again. So if we're going to develop more content that actually links into stuff that's gone before, we can just say, we assume you succeeded here, and now the villain is back again over here. There are a lot of different ways to do it.
And that is very strongly parallel to what you were talking about earlier with Tor.
Yeah.
Right? With role-playing game where they put out adventures and everyone had their own instance of it in their home campaign, and if you sent in your results, they would then use that to decide what would happen in the greater world.
Right.
There's a game that is I cannot talk about that's going to be released. It's going to be announced later this year. I was brought in early for a job I didn't get to help do potentially do some writing, and I stayed in touch with them. I believe that this goal has stayed throughout, that the game is going to be a massively multiplayer game, and it's going to have that kind of interaction, where your instances are going to be recorded, and after a certain period of time, the number of instances, the results of the instances are going to be used to move the whole setting for everyone to become permanent.
Bakugan is actually doing a series of Toys R Us events over the next couple of months that have an interactive story like this. Kids will go to these Toys R Us events and play Bakugan, and as they win votes that influence the way the story will come out. So each one, they show up and they get a little 100-150-word thing that says, here's the story to this point, this or this will happen, cast your votes, that they get based on winning Bakugan games at Toys R Us. And so that's another example of
Five Rings.
They've been doing a great job of that many years. People who win the tournaments in Legend of the Five Rings get to decide who is winning the big battle that they're theoretically playing through. And that determines how the storyline goes from there.
Right. And did you write one of the...
No, it was Steve Sullivan.
Right. I did one, a couple other people wrote some of the novels. Like, 5 years later, they decided they wanted to have books out of them, so what I got was a big list of here's what happened, here are the cards and what we've said about the characters and these events. Make a book out of it.
Okay. That's actually kind of fun. I like
that. But even in that, there were some things in the book that as the larger storyline was going along, and I said, oh, this is how the flow of the story will get. Like, somewhere, 2 points in the middle, I remember, that I got to, and just what happened in this period of a day to 2 days made no sense.
Right.
But that's what happened in the card games, and that's how the story developed, and that's what had to happen in the novel. And so the biggest struggle for me in crafting the novel was figuring out how to make those story points that had to be featured, couldn't be swept off to the side, work in this narrative and not give that kind of feeling you were talking about where you get to page 104 and go, why the hell did that happen?
Right. Well, so you often see that in a story. One of the things that takes you out of a story is when characters' motivations do not match what happens in the plot. Right, why would he do that is the question that takes you out of it. And so, like, when you're making stories, that's the thing to figure out, to make sure that motivation matches plot, goes back to motivation. And so, like, that was the specific challenge he was talking about there, is why would these people do this? That makes no sense. And so, right, then your challenge, presumably, was to figure out Like, yeah. What thing about this character or this faction or whatever would cause that?
Yeah. And, you know, games and stories have different requirements, too. Like, for instance, in Star Trek, they very rarely talk about money, right? But in the Star Trek role-playing game, they needed some kind of currency to actually... And they actually made... When the guys were developing the Star Trek role-playing game, they actually went to Paramount and made a compelling argument that there were some kind of credits in use in the society, right? And they actually got them to include that in the game. But before that, the standard stance was no money in the Federation, right? So, you know, just because there are different requirements in different media, these are things where you're like, wow, let's not even talk about that here. And if you do it on a TV show, nobody's going to say, well, because you just don't talk about it. It's over there someplace. But in a game, when you're playing, you're like, well, I want to get this. Why can't I have that? This might be one.
what I'm really hearing here is in the kind of economy that we have, the entertainment economy, where there's going to be all kinds of different games, movies, board games generated out of this IP, right? That if when she's working on her game, let's say, think about the possibilities outside the game itself.
Yeah. I mean, The other thing, though, is, of course, if you have a great game, somebody will be hired in to come up with a great story that links into it, right?
Right, so why don't you come up with a great story?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you can generate it yourself, and not everybody has some skills, right? Some of the great game designers just don't have any story skills at all.
Right.
This, I think, in Cube represents the ascendance of the Spanish Inquisition.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know, like Matt was saying before, the industry is starting to begin to see the relevance of having writers in at an early level, but the two challenges are it's never been done before, and that didn't stop them. And the I'm going to be a writer. I can write. Exactly. I'll tell you the story.
So you know, some of the most successful ones are the ones where they figured this out stuff out. Like Pokemon is a perfect example. Right? Pokemon is a game or is a story about collecting things. Right? And the story is actually the activity that drives the game, that drives the sales, that drives the story, etc. It's just
fiendish.
It's the most incredibly ingenious, fiendish work together story like that. It just works as a product and as a story on so many different levels. And they engineered it that way. It just works perfectly. Right? It's almost like we figured out how to make crack for kids. Right? And we're going to sell it to them. And they did it, and honestly, it's not bad stuff. I've watched the cartoons of my kids, you know, yeah. And played the game.
I've worked on it in several different incarnations, and besides being amazing, I'm always surprised at how much I like it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, the tagline, gotta catch them all. Win. Exactly. Marketing win. There you go.
There you go. We've earned our million. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or billion, probably.
We'll be asleep in the corner if you need us.
What do? We invented more. No, you have to catch them all.
Exactly. We'll make more. You got about 7 minutes left. Are there more questions? Yes.
If you have a really good game, and you what are the steps of moving that to where you have novelization?
Well, if you have a really good game, people will approach you about it, right? And say, we would like to license this for our novel publishing line. I don't recommend if you're a game developer or a game designer or even a game publisher to suddenly say, we would like to make novels as well, because it's an entirely different industry, right? Or we would like to make computer games as well, or we would like to make stuffed animals as well. You can do these things, but you don't know how to sell them, right? You can sell them to your existing client base, but you don't know how to reach the people outside of that who might be interested in them. But, you know, in certain situations, of course, like, you know, you have plush Cthulhus around the show here. That's cool. People buy them because they're fun. But I usually say you should try to find the people who have the infrastructure and the expertise to actually do these things properly and been doing it for a while, rather than trying to reinvent the wheel yourself.
Although it is sometimes a useful IP development exercise, right? So if you have a board game that you've designed, but you're trying to still figure out what is the world like, sitting down to write for yourself without necessarily any ideas of publication, a short story or an outline for a novel or a screenplay or whatever, that can help you figure out what it is that you've got.
And then you can submit that to other publishers, or you can actually reach out to people and say, look, I know you guys at Pocketbooks do all these different licenses or a Random House or whatever, and I have this great game, we've got a great story behind it, can I pitch you this novel? Right? And sometimes you hire agents to help you out with these kind of things. There are people who know how to do that. And so there are a lot of different ways to come at it. There's not only one way to do it. And if you have a lot of experience in this, you can actually, like we were talking about before, sit down and come up with a story and then pitch it as a novel, a comic book, a movie, a game, etc. But you have to have a lot of contacts or know people to pull that off.
Although the distribution chain is shorter and shorter, right?
That's
true. You can go back to your hotel room and 24 hours from now be selling your story for Kindles on Amazon.
Right, exactly. So that is changing rapidly.
Yeah, I was just thinking the Dresden Files RPG is the most beautiful, iconic example of this. Where, if people aren't familiar...
Who's familiar?
I just saw the book from the RPG.
And Dresden Files is an urban fantasy written by Jim Butcher about the only wizard in the phone book in Chicago.
Yeah.
The only wizard detective in Chicago.
And as a result, I think someone approached his agent for to produce a role-playing game.
Oh, they know the guys.
They know.
And then the agent said, Jim, don't you know these guys that you were gaming with? That maybe wouldn't you be more comfortable if they were handling the game?
That's right.
He said, oh, yeah, yeah. Hey, Fred.
So that's actually a really good idea, a really good example of a close collaboration between an author and game designer / publishers that has come out very well.
Yeah. What was Archaea, which was by, it was a comic book, Archaea,
right.
A fantasy book. And what's the guy's name?
Smiley.
Right. Mark Smiley. And Mark was a gamer, right? So he actually turned around and published his own Fusion system version of that. He did his own role-playing game for it, licensed somebody else's system. He said, nobody's going to do it better than me. I know this stuff backwards and forwards. I can do the artwork and the writing, too. And he's one of those incredibly multi-talented guys who can pull that kind of thing off. He is.
And then went and brought and gave us
Mouse Guard. He now publishes Mouse Guard, which is a fantastic comic book.
And
a role-playing
game.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm the designer of that game is the Burning Wheel guy.
Yeah.
Yep. So it all comes together.
We all know each other. There's this bar.
We try not to say incestuous.
Exactly. All right.
One more I think we got time for if anybody's got one. Or we can go get coffee sooner.
You've talked a lot about how you do all have, or the distinction between game design and story, and I agree with you both, but you've also talked about how you all have a variety of multifaceted talents, you know, artist, writer, designer. So how important is it to either be a specialist or a generalist or just be able to do it all in terms of actually...
Well, you don't have choices about that usually, right? I mean, like, I can't draw for shit. I would love to be able to draw, right? My drawings are very cartoony. I mean, I could draw John Kabbalah probably. Right? But John's the best cartoonist ever, and or Stan here too. The other cartoons, I'm talking about. But you know, I can draw at that level, but I'm not even that level. Honestly, it would be stick figures would be my level of drawing, and I really don't want to spend the time and effort it takes to make me a decent artist, right? And most people are like that; they just follow whatever they're good at, and we don't all have those skills. We just some people happen to have picked up the genetic lottery that gives them everything. Yeah, more power to them. The rest of us have to find friends or partners or hire people who can do those things too. And that's just as easy.
But also, here's the critical thing, I think, is to know what you want to do and
right.
then sort of only do that. You could invest the time and become an illustrator, but if you don't want to, you shouldn't like feel like you have to do that because it's expected. Or like if you want to write fiction but not be a game designer, there's no need for you to learn to become a designer because there's plenty of designers out there. So like a little bit of self-knowledge goes a real long way in figuring out how much you, right? Don't let anybody put should on you. You should be a story guy. You should be a writer.